RadioInfluence.com.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Dark to Light podcast with Frank and Beans. Frank had to jump off. We just did an hour-long interview with Mike Yoder, the attorney on the Church versus Biden lawsuit that I have been talking about on Telegram and on Uncover DC for the past couple days. It is really hitting a fever pitch now, and there's a lot of questions, sort of minutia about the facts, how you go about these arguments, what they mean. We hit on all of that stuff here. Put on your thinking caps. We do get a little bit in depth about philosophy and how the law is practiced and things like that in regards to what is happening with these vaccine mandates. One of the things we just talked about off air that I wanted to mention to you is that regardless of when you started believing in God, it could have been yesterday, there is nobody that can really question what your sincerely held religious beliefs are. And that would be a bigger argument. And as you'll hear in the podcast, you'll understand why I'm saying this now. It would be a bigger argument and it probably would go through some litigation. But at the end of the day, those are your beliefs. So there's a bunch in here. We have a little bit of a debate about some things. It's a really good interview. Make sure you listen to the entire thing. We answer a ton of questions. If you are a federal employee right now, that means military or federal government. And even if you're a government contractor, which we touch on just a little bit in here, make sure you listen to this interview. I will have all of the information linked in the show notes below. Again, Mike Yoder is a brilliant attorney, and I'm really glad that he's the one who has this case. And you'll understand why in just a minute. So without further ado, here is the interview with Mike Yoder. So the show that everyone's been waiting for is here. We are joined with, I'm going to call you constitutional attorney. Is that an adequate description of you?
Yeah, I think we can go with that.
All right. So Mike Yoder's here with me, and I met Mike years ago through all the Spygate saga, and he's just a freaking brilliant attorney. Not very many of them left, as we're learning. Very few, actually. And so the other day, Uncover DC covered this lawsuit that Mike has filed on behalf of how many? 40 plaintiffs, right?
Well, there were 13 or 14 in the first suit. The second suit had 20.
Yeah, so around 34 or so plaintiffs against the Biden administration just to fight back against the fact that he has, he included in the lawsuit is footage from a Zoom call from the task force that Biden created to enforce this, quote, vaccine mandate, which is blatantly unconstitutional in many ways. But the footage that one is in this lawsuit basically shows the Biden task force illegally scheming to deny religious exemptions to federal employees who are objecting to the vaccine on religious grounds, as well as the fact that the federal government is altering the medical records of some people to indicate that they have received the community Pfizer shot when that shot in fact doesn't exist. So Mike, I'm going to give the floor to you to kind of go over this lawsuit for people. And then there's a ton of questions that I want to ask you about it that are coming in from various social platforms. So take the stage.
Yeah. So the very first thing that I noticed was just, once the FDA approval letter came out on August 23, I was very curious as to why the J&J and Moderna vaccines were still available under EUA, which is emergency use authorization. EUA is only available when there is not an FDA approved drug or medical product. And it is an important statute to have, because what it does is if there's some sort of outbreak or some sort of pandemic, like what we're facing with COVID, and they do have the ability to create a drug or an antidote or a vaccine, it is important that people do have that option to seek such treatment. But the conditions that are imposed under EUA are fairly stringent. And the two most relevant ones as to this deal with the option to accept or refuse the treatment and being informed of the risks, benefits, consequences of such treatment. But it all comes down to informed consent. And naturally, if there is an FDA-approved product, then there by definition cannot be another product that's also licensed under EUA. So the issue being that, oh, the Pfizer vaccine is FDA approved. And then I'm curious as to, well, why are there still J&J vaccines being administered, or why is there Moderna still circulating in the market? Which got me to dig into the letter. And as I'm digging through the FDA approval letter, I noticed it says specifically in a footnote on page 5 that the Pfizer vaccines, plural, and there's a difference between the two of them. One is Comirnaty, which had received FDA approval. The other is Pfizer BioNTech. And I just refer to it as BioNTech and then Comirnaty. Comirnaty was FDA approved. The problem is that it doesn't exist in the United States. No individual has ever received this vaccine. No one can get this vaccine. It operates effectively like a concept car. It's a real car. You can see it. You can touch it. You can go to the car show, the Mercedes-Benz car show, and see it on the floor. But you can't buy it. You can't get it. You can't acquire it. You can't ask for it. It doesn't exist in terms of its population or its production. So then I wondered, well, if Pfizer has two vaccines, what are these quote unquote legal distinctions and certain differences between the two vaccines? And that's when I started to dig, getting FOIA requests, and it comes to reality that the vaccines are different. And what those differences are, the redactions are there for quote unquote proprietary or trade secret purposes, which I found to be ironic, because if this is such a massive pandemic and the objective is to stem the spread of COVID-19, then why is it that the FDA would grant approval to a company that's effectively refusing to allow others to manufacture to help speed up and produce other vaccines that could ultimately save more people? But that's the problem. So I don't really know where the issue is with the understanding, other than the massive misinformation campaign that's been launched that tells everyone, oh, the Pfizer vaccine is FDA approved. Well, using the name Pfizer vaccine, using that term in the singular sense, is antithetical, because it's just false. And then I noticed in the executive order, even looking at the actual executive order, there's a bold-faced lie from the very, very beginning. And it is just mind-blowing to me that this is not known.
So the press has basically taken a monopoly on telling everyone that Pfizer is FDA approved, and they use that to be able to coerce more people into getting this vaccine. And also, I think, to be able to, make these supposed mandates on especially federal government workers. Now, private companies are a different animal that we'll get into, but, the federal government is using the fact that this vaccine is FDA approved to force people into getting it or fire them, because they can't do that with an EUA, if I'm not mistaken. They can't force you to get a vaccine under an EUA, but they can if it's FDA approved. Is that correct?
Correct. So, yeah, because what they can do is, so that what they're doing is they're couching in the phrasing that you have to be informed of the consequences of the risks, the benefits, the consequences. Well, they've conditioned as a consequence your employment. And obviously, when you look to the legislative intent of the statute, what they were talking about was the consequences of receiving it or not receiving the medical treatment, things of that nature. They can't put a fundamental right as a condition of employment and make that a consequence of getting the vaccine or not.
So you had plaintiffs come to you. You had these plaintiffs come to you. You were kind of, you're out there. You've got these folks that come to you. You put this case together. You do a fantastic job of laying all of this out, again, on the basis that religious freedom is a supreme right in this country. It cannot be infringed, that people who have sincerely held religious beliefs have the right to object to the injection of a substance into their body, which goes against those beliefs. And you lay that out in the complaint very clearly. What you were asking for in the initial complaint, you didn't, but you filed right after and asked for a temporary restraining order. Can you explain what you were asking for the restraining order on, like specifically?
Yeah. So essentially what I'm trying to do, and the reason that I have two different lawsuits, is because the first issue goes down into the fact that people don't have a mechanism by which they can submit a religious exemption request. And I say that loosely, with an asterisk next to it, because, you know, if you don't know the law, you don't understand how this works, and you don't have a predisposition to naturally think that your employers are going to be trying to dissuade you, or that they're going to be giving you false information, or doing something as diabolical effectively as what's going on, you don't really know. And the problem is that there is no actual mechanism that an employer there is no mechanism that the employer can use to force you into this tunnel. And that's really where the problem lies. So what I wanted to do was use this lawsuit to force the government to provide clear guidance as to how people can obtain submit their exemption requests, and then force the government's hand to make a decision. And it's not a long, difficult process to review someone's exemption request. It doesn't even have to be in writing as a matter of law. All you have to do is place them on notice of it, request a reasonable accommodation. And so long as the accommodation you request does not cause an undue hardship on the employer, then it is, you're entitled to it as a matter of law. Title VII, for the last half century, has ensured that employers are obligated as a matter of law to provide reasonable accommodations for members of protected classes, such as those with disabilities or those who engage in a certain religious practice.
So meaning like undue harm, meaning like if you are on a line in an assembly factory, what happens if you need a religious exemption and their policy says you need to be vaccinated to be on the line? What does that mean for that employer? Just out of curiosity.
What that means is really like that you just need to submit. Like, I mean, think to yourself, who do you submit your letters to that you want to take a day off for, or that your kid's out sick, or that you have a doctor's appointment? When you go through that, typically like an HR individual or a supervisor or whomever, all you have to do is put them on notice about the fact that you're requesting an accommodation, and just saying, hey, I have a religious belief that prohibits me from, you know, complying with this. As a reasonable accommodation, I suggest A, B, C, X, Y, Z. Or if, same thing with a medical condition, you make that suggestion and then they typically honor it. I mean, traditionally, the best example I can come up with and think about is, you know, let's say you have a work luncheon and someone is Jewish and, you know, they're serving some sort of pork dish, and you just say, oh, hey, sorry, I'm Jewish and I actually don't eat pork. Is there a way that I could just get a chicken dish instead? And then you're like, and you're supervisor or boss like, oh yeah, no problem, is that, can we just get you like a roasted chicken breast or something, is that fine? Sure, no big deal. That's how it's always transpired historically. And the reason now that it's such a big deal is because the case law isn't extremely well developed. I mean, there's enough there that you can work with it, especially with like the Hobby Lobby case and City of Hialeah, but the biggest thing is that it's such an asinine proposal to challenge the veracity of one's religious belief for a political agenda, that no one has been audacious enough to really do it to the point where it got locked up in court. I'm sure it's happened time and time again, but to the gravity or the level that reaches, you know, binding case law, typically it would just get thrown out or laughed at. You know, but now we're actually seeing it come to fruition, and that's where the biggest rub is, in terms of how do you define what constitutes a sincerely held religious belief, and whether the government can use its, you know, go-to bread and butter pandemic emergency nonsense to override the Constitution as they have for the past, you know, 2 years effectively.
So let's just get into that real quick. So basically the Biden task force had a meeting where they, for lack of a better word, said, you know, we're just trying to gather data right now when people submit these religious exemption requests. Don't grant any of them, because if you grant one, it's really hard to say that you're going to grant other ones. We're going to hold all these, figure out why people are asking for the exemptions, then figure out how we can challenge that and deny them. Is that it? Basically, what's in the lawsuit?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. So I have a video footage from the task force from an October 8 meeting, where a gentleman by the name of Sam Berger is speaking and instructing nearly 200 high-level officials in the various agencies on how they can promulgate or carry out this agenda. And the manner in which he's going about it is not telling them, hey, this is what we need to do. This is how you need to make it available for people to submit requests. This is, you know, the criteria upon which you should grant the request. This is the criteria that you could probe more. No, it's not structured like that. It's a very skewed, intentional policy, and it's been plotted out as effectively a scheme where they want you to get funneled into submitting information on these questionnaires that have been issued to the various agencies, and those questionnaires have then obviously trickled their way down into the private sector. They've gone into the federal contracting arena very heavily, and the questions are designed to elicit specific information. They ask questions like, have you, since the age of 18, received any other vaccine, or have you taken Tylenol or over the counter? How long have you had this belief? You know, like, people are trying to push for pastor's letters, or they're saying,
isn't that all illegal?
So yes and no. I don't want to say, quote unquote, it's all illegal, because it's not facially illegal. It depends on a circumstantial basis. So in order for an employer to inquire about the veracity of one's belief or the sincerity of one's religious belief, the employer must first have an objective basis that gives rise to a bona fide doubt in that sincerity. Meaning, let's say, for example, you wear an upside down cross every day. You have a pride flag in your office. You love Antifa, wear black. You think you're transgender, and you go to every pro-choice march in the city. But now you're a Roman Catholic who's unable to get vaccinated because it violates your religious beliefs. Well, if you're an employer, there's a good chance that you have an objective basis there to not fully believe that individual is in fact a Roman Catholic. So then you can begin a limited inquiry to try to vet that and establish whether the belief is sincere or not. But the bottom line is the fact that you need that objective basis first before you can open a probe. Whereas here, what we're seeing is that the government is asking questions and using questionnaires to get information that they then use as what they call the objective basis to inquire further or to probe or to deny. And that's where the issue is with those questions, because by asking, have you taken a vaccine since the age of 18? What they're getting at is, oh, well, if that doesn't align, if you say you've been Catholic since birth, but you got a vaccine at 19, and now you're in your 22nd year working for Homeland Security, well, you violated your faith then, so what makes it so important now? And the difference is, first off, that's just a stupid question. Whatever lawyer wrote this, you know, might want to look into a different profession. But the basis of beliefs and the way that religion works is that, first off, it's based on the knowledge of the individual. You know, if a Jewish person would have taken a bite of that salad that had bacon bits in it at lunch and then realized there was bacon in it, did he do anything wrong? No, he does something wrong if he takes a second bite. That's the mentality. You can't be committing a sin if you're not knowledgeable of what it is that you're doing or what it is that's available or known to you. Because most people for the past, I'd say probably even as recent as 3 years ago, did not know the number of medications or medical products that were manufactured or derived from fetal cell lines. And I'm not saying, and this is something that's very important that I want to be unequivocally clear on, I am not saying there is fetal tissue or fetal cells in the vaccine. I am saying that they were derived from it. So think about chicken marsala. You have to have marsala in order to make chicken marsala. There has to be alcohol in the marsala in order for it to be marsala. However, once you use the marsala, you cook the dish and you start eating, you're not eating alcohol. It burns out. But it breaks down to, but for the existence of alcohol, you could not create chicken marsala. So you can see the connection there, and you can see how it's a step attenuated from literally injecting your body with fetal cell. But it's still a fundamental religious belief that if it was not for the killing and aborting of innocent life and fetuses, these vaccines could not exist. And that's where the religious belief rests.
Understand. And I think that's important. A lot of people don't get that. A lot of people don't make that distinction or understand it. So what happened was this: you got into a hearing. I'm summarizing here based on what I know from the docket. You were in a phone hearing. The government said, well, this is mishmash. You know, we're not doing anything. This lawsuit is too early. It's the same thing we saw with all the election law lawsuits. Well, no one's been harmed yet. And then afterwards, well, it's too late. So now you're in a place where the government's arguing, well, no one has been fired. So, you know, this lawsuit's brought too early. And then you say, well, you guys are going to terminate people by November 8th if X, Y, and Z doesn't happen or you don't approve their religious exemption. And the government says, well, no, we're not. And then you say, well, I'd love to see that in writing. And the judge says, you know what? I agree with you. Can you please submit that in writing? Is that adequate, what I've just explained?
Well, yeah. So, like, emergency injunctive relief is one of the most, heavily guarded mechanisms you have as a lawyer, and you don't use it under any circumstance that's shy of an emergency, because the difference between a TRO and a preliminary injunction is that a TRO can be issued ex parte, which means without the other side having knowledge or having their say or having their voice heard. But that, for that reason, it's limited only to 14 days because of due process concerns. I mean, imagine you're a business operating and producing a product, and the next thing you know, you get slammed with a TRO halting it. You know, you haven't even had a chance to give your piece yet. So you can see the judicial concerns of equity and fairness in issuing TROs, which is why they're limited to 14 days. But the reason I filed it is because the termination date currently is set at November 22nd, but they have an arbitrary 2-week gap between the date by which you have to be inoculated in order to be fully inoculated, meaning the second dose of a 2-dose series, or now, which obviously the deadline has passed to do that, you're only subject to getting a J&J or Moderna vaccine in order to satisfy the November 8th deadline, i.e. giving the 2-week gap so you can be recognized as fully vaccinated by November 22nd. And I said, Your Honor, we only have 10 days before people have, the issue isn't whether they're going to get fully vaccinated or not. The issue is the moment that needle goes in that body and that vaccine is injected, that's really what the crux of the issue is. And I said, this is an emergency. And the government responded, oh, it's not ripe. No one's been terminated yet. And I said, well, the whole point of me filing this motion is to prevent people from being terminated. It's not about after they're terminated, we're going to retroactively fix the situation. I want to prevent people from being fired before they get fired, not only just to protect their careers and their livelihoods and their families and their rights, but we can't just fall into a situation in which we don't have a functioning government or a ready military. I mean, China's over there sending, you know, missiles that circle the earth, and we're worrying about giving a transgender four-star general award and she works for Health and Human Services. Or, I mean, what are we doing? Our military is more concerned about, Pride Month than they are dealing with Afghanistan, where we just laundered effectively $85 billion worth of equipment through the Taliban to the CCP after they took it into Iran and the CCP came and got it. It's just an absolute disgrace. And it's scary to realize that you're in a country and the fact that they would prioritize their political agenda and their economic bottom line over the safety of our borders, not getting into the immigration issue yet. That's a whole nother problem I have. But dealing with the fact that we will just be nothing more than a sitting duck to a foreign attack if this actually goes through, because we do not have a active duty military anymore. We do not have a functioning government. And yes, I am saying that despite the ridiculousness that is the circus on Capitol Hill currently and the head clown on Pennsylvania Ave, we're dealing with a functioning government in comparison to what it would be without, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who would be losing their jobs. So the government said no one's been fired yet. And I said, well, I don't want to find out what happens if they do. And they said, well, look, we're not going to terminate any of the plaintiffs while their religious exemption or their exemption requests are pending, or, you know, and they still have the opportunity to appeal it and go through like the appeals process and then like the EEOC with a charge of discrimination. I said, okay, well, if you're willing to put that in writing, then I'm more than happy to withdraw my motion. And the judge, you know, was like, that's reasonable, and looks at the, you know, the government, and they're just like, I don't have the authority to say, I'd say that I need to talk to someone. I mean, of course you're not going to just put that in writing. You think I was born yesterday? So the point comes down to you're saying that it's hypothetical that anyone's going to be fired, and therefore the motion is not ripe for adjudication. Yet you're telling me that no one's going to be fired, and I'm supposed to take that at face value. So my assertion is that people are going to be fired based on what is currently the standing guidance issued by the task force. So I actually have something to rely on to form my opinion. They're just trying to give me their word and say that no one's going to be fired. Well, isn't that equally, if not more, hypothetical than what I'm saying? And the judge said, I'm not convinced that, like, you know, if that's your position, then put it in writing and give it to us. And then they didn't do it when the judge gave them 24 hours. And the judge responded saying, yeah, this doesn't cut it. You have till noon today to give me what I'm asking for. So, I mean, the judge is being very fair. One of the most fair jurists on the bench. I mean, obviously I've litigated before all of them, but especially in DC, she's a pleasure to litigate before, and she's always been a genuine, I mean, it goes to show volumes about her that she was initially appointed by Reagan to the Superior Court, and then Clinton appointed her to the federal bench. So getting that bipartisan nomination is something that I think is noteworthy about what a judge truly should be and truly embody, is just like the impartiality. But yeah, the government doesn't have a reason, and it's very, you know, it's very enjoyable to see justice upheld finally.
Yeah, it's that's the one thing that I said yesterday, is like, finally. So what everybody's saying now is, well, does this apply to everybody? So here's what I've been saying, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Mike. So if the government files something new today that says what the judge is looking for, that says basically no action will be taken against these employees, at least for the course of this lawsuit, if they have submitted a religious exemption and it has been denied, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. If they don't submit that, does your temporary restraining order, which I assume will be granted by the judge, apply as a blanket across the entire government or only to your plaintiffs?
So it is sort of, no, it's two steps. So follow me. The order would apply specifically to the plaintiffs. However, if the order applies to the plaintiffs, then you trigger an equal protection issue where, hey, I'm just in the same situation as these guys. So how come they're not subject to being fired, but I am? So there is it provides the baseline for everyone to have the same protection, even if their name isn't on the page. So it's just like, and let me give an example of why it's not a class action. If you were driving your car and you got pulled over and the cop finds marijuana in the car and arrests you and you get charged with possession of marijuana, and then you hire a lawyer and you argue that this possession of marijuana statute is unconstitutional, and then the next month you win. Well, then if I get pulled over in December and they find marijuana in my car and then they charge me with possession of marijuana, can they do that? Of course not, because that law was just found to be unconstitutional. So even though it doesn't apply directly to you, it gives you a legal mechanism upon which you can say, hey, these people got different treatment than me. This violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Fifth Amendment. So therefore, if you can't fire these employees, you can't fire me. So it's a one-step attenuation, but the salient point, the way that it breaks down, is that no one is going to lose their jobs if they have a religious exemption pending, or if it's in the appeals process, either with the internal department or the internal agency of their employer, or with the EEOC once a charge of discrimination is filed. And once you get into the EEOC, that can take a very, very long time.
So let's go through quickly the steps for people if they're a federal employee, because everybody in my chat and elsewhere is saying he needs to do a class action lawsuit. You know, can I retain him? How do I go about this? What am I supposed to do? Or I submitted mine. What if it's rejected? Nobody has any clue how to navigate this. Can you give like a boilerplate sort of a way that people can get more information and understand this process? I know you're one person, Mike, so obviously you can't take on a case for every single federal employee.
Yeah, so the first thing that you guys can do is you can go to www.yoderesq.com, yoderesq.com, and I have consultations where I do daily workshops with people, just going through and explaining everything into greater detail than what I'm doing here, but on how you can protect yourself. But what you need to do is first, and let me caveat before I even get into this, is that I do not encourage, condone, or in any uncertain terms, advocate for someone abusing the First Amendment and saying that they have sincerely held religious beliefs when they in fact do not. Because if you do not have genuine, sincere beliefs that are anti-abortion or something else that is viable as to supporting a reason why you cannot be vaccinated, I very much so oppose that, because we cannot, A, lower ourselves to their level and start abusing the Constitution when it's politically advantageous for us. And secondly, it's a core principle and fundamental right that if we abuse just out of simple morality, and we do not want to lower ourselves to their level, but we cannot start taking advantage of the protections our founding fathers provided, because as soon as you start taking advantage of it, that subjects it to being taken away. People can say it's being weaponized and needs to be revised, so do not abuse it.
So stop there for 1 second. Let's just get into this quickly. What this is another argument I'm seeing that everybody, I think it's a valid one. Like, why are we even here in the first place? Why do I need to use my religious beliefs to avoid being mandated to get a shot? Right?
Exactly.
Why do I need to use this in the first place? What is there? Like, why is everyone only focusing on religious exemptions? How come we can't focus on the fact that I just don't want this? And
that's
my life.
Surrender.
Yeah.
That's a surrender in itself.
So explain that, because you have a philosophy about that, right?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing is that, you know, making sure that if you're using your religious or your medical exemptions, you're getting those submitted early. And sorry, you broke up a little bit. I thought you were asking.
No,
about
I'm asking. I was, but I stopped to ask this other question. The other question is this: why is it that we have to fight to get them to accept a religious exemption when we have the right to deny this flat out without having a sincerely held religious belief and not have our livelihood used as a cudgel against us? So people who are not in the religious exemption camp, Mike, who just don't want the shot and don't want to be fired, are asking everybody, why are all these lawyers just focusing on people who have religious exemptions and not focusing on your inherent freedom as a person? So like, why are we caving in to a religious exemption or a medical exemption rather than just saying, no, we're not doing this? And what legal rights do people have if they don't want to use a religious exemption to avoid it?
Well, I think the first thing is that, do you get in a boxing ring and think that you're going to take one swing and knock Muhammad Ali out, or are you going to have to tire him out over 10 rounds? Because people think that you can just stand firm and be stubborn and say, this is my right, yada, yada, yada. I don't have to take this. It's not FDA approved. Well, you have two different hurdles there. First, you have to prove that it's not FDA approved, because the misinformation campaign has had some pretty significant gravity to it in terms of people actually believing this stuff. Secondly, you have to show that it's irreparable or irreparable harm, because if you're going to argue that you don't have to take it because it's not FDA approved, then you're essentially saying, okay, so long as the FDA issues an approval on one of the other non-FDA approved vaccines under EUA, then now all of a sudden you're going to take it?
Well, no,
you're going to get upset then too.
Why do you even need FDA approval? Like, why are people forced to take it with FDA approval? Like, what's the difference? If you don't want it, you don't want it. Like, that's what I think the big argument within is, Mike, is that people are saying, I don't care if it's FDA approved or not. I'm not putting that in my body, and I shouldn't have my paycheck held over my head because of it. Do they have any grounds whatsoever, or do we need to go through this process first to be able to get to their grounds?
I mean, we have to go through this process first, of course. I mean, employers are lawfully allowed, not only just allowed, they're almost required to take mitigation strategies and safety measures to ensure the safety of their employees. Just like, your employer can require you to wear a hard hat if you're working on a construction site. Why? So you're safe. So they're construing it in that arena. And I know the next question is going to be, well, the vaccine isn't safe. Okay, well, the only way you can prove it is or is not safe is based on science. So if you're saying that there's enough science to indicate that it is safe, then that science is the same amount and the same amount of time has passed to show that it is safe. So you can't have one without the other by saying it is safe, it isn't safe, the efficacy isn't there, the efficacy is there. The science point blank is just very juvenile. It's young. It has not been fully developed yet, despite the number of adverse effects. And I mean, obviously, this is unlike any other vaccine before. I personally do not in any way believe that it is safe, but my personal opinions are not the way that I have to operate within the confines of the law. So if your employer says you have to take, you have to do A, B, or C to ensure the safety of your coworkers, your employer's allowed to do that. That's what they're relying on in terms of using the vaccine as a crutch to compel mass vaccination. And absent the nature of injecting it into your body, that raises a different concern. But it has not yet been litigated yet. And I mean, again, you have to remember this order was issued a month and 20 days ago. I mean, this order is less than 2 months old. So to go from him signing an executive order to pushing it all the way up through to federal court with the evidence that I have and getting a judge that is halting or forcing the government to, back up is incredibly fast. I don't know, I don't think I've seen a case get pushed this fast before. So it's not like things aren't going as good as they could be going.
Right.
But it takes time.
Yes.
And a lot of this is just procedural stuff that, non-lawyers don't understand. And I understand the frustration even as a lawyer. But you don't have to take a vaccine if it's not FDA approved. But if it's FDA approved, your employer by law can mandate it. If you have an issue with that, then you need to worry about discussing revisions to the labor laws and what confines within which are they allowed to take a reasonable safety measure. You know, what my argument was, especially with the people that work from home, it goes way too far because, oh, well, we need to vaccinate them just to ensure continuity of government, because if they're out of their jobs and things aren't getting done, and that could be dangerous to like national security. Okay, well, do you want to tell Mrs. Smith that she can't drive to the grocery store either because she might get in a car accident, and that could have the same effect? I mean, she could. Where does the line get drawn over what you can do to regulate to promote this national security interest or you know, continuity of government or maintaining the status quo? It's way too far reaching. I mean, frankly, the principles of common sense and logic have just been so far abandoned that this is why we're in the situation we're in. If you just look at the law, then you apply common sense. Oh, hey, this person is a foreign service officer for Department of State. He obviously has to go to a foreign country. If a foreign country's laws say you have to be vaccinated to enter, well, sure, your employer can mandate that you get vaccinated because you obviously can't do your job if you can't go into the other country. That's a different situation. That right there is an example of an undue hardship. Same thing applies if you're if someone is in a wheelchair and want to become a Secret Service agent or a police officer or something of that sort. Of course, they can discriminate against you on the basis of your disability because it's lawful discrimination in that you can't perform the duties, meaning you wouldn't be able to run and chase a suspect. There's other things that you are just physically incapable of doing by virtue of your disability. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just the way that it shakes out and the way that it works. If you don't have, imagine being, you want to be I'm sure that there's always an exception to every rule, but someone that doesn't have arms being a courtroom stenographer, it's like, you can't, I'm sure that you could in a certain way, but you don't function within the confines of what's actually, I'm trying to make an absolute statement. I don't want to make a caveat because there's always going to be this one person that's always like, well, I was able to do it
with my chin or my toes or whatever.
I'm just like, yes, but I'm not talking about that. Like generally speaking. So, those are the main issues there. So that's why people are saying, I just don't want to get it. I'm not going to do it. I mean, you can fight it out in court, but you're going to be what you're going to have to litigate is the labor standards that allow employers to take safety measures for their employees. That's not even about the vaccine mandate itself. You're going to have to change that purview to then say that this falls within what you're trying to nix from that other law.
And I think that that's the biggest thing that I wanted to get to here is that focusing on what the mechanism is that causes this to be allowed in the first place is what's really the avenue you have to go down rather than arguing the science behind it or the efficacy of it. Or even though we know where those facts and data lie, you say that it's too early. I say it's been quite some time. We know quite a lot about how this thing works. Proving it out in a court of law is dependent upon so many factors, the judge, the other side, how they argue, what, you know, whatever. So that's not even necessarily the best course of action, which is why this particular lawsuit is so powerful. It takes a different course of action and it supports the First Amendment in that people have sincerely held religious beliefs that putting this FDA approved or not, honestly, in their bodies is against their very strong personally held religious beliefs. So back to the first question that I was asking you before I interrupted you. So the steps you take, you file your religious exemption with the government. If you're a government employee, what next?
Wait, I mean, you get your religious exemption request submitted and it's actually a religious accommodation for a vaccination exemption. What you're doing is you're requesting an accommodation for your sincerely held religious beliefs, which in turn is what you're relying upon to be exempt from the vaccine mandate. So it's not a religious exemption per se, but that's like sort of the term that's been used and thrown around. And I get that it's kind of confusing, but you're seeking an accommodation for your religious beliefs. And once you submit that, you wait. If you want to submit it, just send it to your HR or your email. And I know that the next thing is going to be, well, I was told that I had to submit it through this portal. No, you don't. That's what you were told. Federal employees are traditionally very accustomed to just listening. They just say, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Okay, I'll do that. They take instructions. They don't ever think about questioning like, well, wait, why do I have to do this? Or why should I do that? Well, that right there is what's being taken advantage of. If you submit it via email, you place your employer on notice that you've submitted a request for a religious exemption and they have it. Tough luck. You have a preference of how you want people to submit it. They don't have to do it as a matter of law. and there's nothing you can really say or do and force them into this tunnel. But nonetheless, there's no point in fighting futile battles. If you have a portal, I would just go through and do that and get it. Like, what, you know, pick a battle that's worth fighting. Don't waste your energy on things that you can avoid. You, as long as you submit it and you get confirmation that they have in fact received your exemption request, you know, or your accommodation request, then that's all you need to do. So get it submitted and wait. And as long as you're waiting, you're fine. And stop worrying about these deadlines. There is no deadline. I've even posted a video of the task force saying and acknowledging that there is no deadline. They can't legally enforce a deadline because there's no statute or clause within the Constitution that says your First Amendment rights expire 2 weeks before the government picks an arbitrary deadline. It's not how it works. You could submit it whenever you want. But if you do submit it, I would... Why wait to the point where you have to dig yourself out of the hole that they're going to throw up in front of you with that hurdle? Just because you're entitled to that right doesn't mean that you're not going to have to fight to maintain it. And that's what a lot of people forget about, is that they're very principled and saying, oh, I don't have to do this or that. Well, my thing is, you don't have to, but you're going to, because their government's going to put you in a situation where if the government just stops paying you, okay, they just stop paying you and it's unlawful, you're going to have to fight to get that back. Just because it's unlawful doesn't mean you get to hit a little red bell under your desk saying, oops, unlawful, and it's fixed. You have to fight to get that back. So don't make it harder on yourself by, you know, like, essentially just don't be a jackass. Don't create bigger problems for yourself out of being stubborn beyond, like, being so principled that it's detrimental to yourself. If they have a deadline, just submit it before the deadline. If they have a way of going through it, just go through the process the way you're supposed to go through the process to appease them. Just, you know, indulge them in doing what you're supposed to be doing. And also, being adversarial is not going to get you anywhere. Have you ever yelled at a cop that pulled you over and then he's like, oh, well, since you were rude to me today, now I'm going to let you go? No, it's not how it works. So just kind of play the game, but be firm when it comes down to being firm. If they, like, where I say draw the line is when they send you the questionnaire and say, you need to fill this out, be like, no, I don't. First off, I'm not agreeing to that privacy statement that requires me to give my information of state and federal law enforcement or in local law enforcement. Second of all, I'm not telling you any of this stuff because you haven't given me a proof of what objective basis you have to inquire about these questions. There's various mechanisms you can go about with to determine this. One way you can say is, oh, well, why am I getting this? Am I in trouble? Is this something targeting me? Why do you not believe me? Or is this just something you sent into the whole company? Well, of course, they're going to respond, oh, this is just a company-wide policy. Well, there you go. Now they don't have an objective basis that gives them a bona fide belief in your doubt, because they just said that they're just sending it to everyone. The reasonable inference is that they don't know anything about you or your belief. So how can they ask you questions? You just got them to admit that in writing. Or you just say, please see attached, please see attached, please see attached, please see attached. You answer the questions by just giving them another copy of what you submit as your exemption request. They can't say you didn't answer it because you answered it. You just told them to look attached. And on your attachment, you perhaps didn't give them the information they were looking for. And that's their problem, not yours. So there's different ways that you can go around it and not give in to what they want you to give them, because they're going to try to elicit that information, and that's going to be the very bait that they use to deny your request. So they're on a massive fishing expedition, and that's not lawful.
So then once, let's just say they deny you, because we've seen the blanket denials come through. When you appeal, and we're talking about government employees right now, when you appeal, what do you do then? They can't terminate you during appeal, correct?
Correct. It's still, and that's what Judge Collar-Cotelli was saying, was that this exists and extends beyond even into the pendency of the appeals process. This elongates, this goes on even into the point where you're appealing internally within your agency. And then with the EEOC, so until a final decision is reached, they can't terminate you. The good thing is that, let's say that you go through all that, you go through the internal appeals, you go through the EEOC, you know, you get to the end of the road and you're denied. Well, that's the one thing that the government was just arguing that we don't have standing for and why the case should be dismissed. So if that does happen, now we're getting into the root of the constitutionality of the actual issue. So you come in and say, look, Your Honor, I was actually fired. I've actually lost my job. Here's a Friday statement from my bank that shows I did not receive a direct deposit, as I've previously been entitled to the last 35 years. And this is unconstitutional. I should not have lost my job over this. Well, now the issue is ripe for adjudication, and that's when we can get into really litigating the teeth and the meat of the constitutionality.
So there are some people in that position, Mike. I've got them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to add into my lawsuit. I have not spoken with any federal employee that's been officially terminated. And also they had, and also the issue is if they've been terminated, did they go through the appeals process? Because if they didn't, then they subjected themselves to failing to exhaust their remedies. So they wouldn't be a right plaintiff. If you get told that your letter is denied and you get fired, but you didn't ever appeal it internally, I can't do anything with that. You didn't protect yourself. File a charge with the EEOC. You didn't protect yourself.
Is there a limit on the amount of time you have that you can file that appeal if you're in that situation?
Yes. I do not want to speak to the dates as to how long you have in terms of filing it with the within different agencies. But when you're going with the EEOC, there are very, very, very stringent timelines. You have 180 days from the date of in which the discrimination took place to file a charge with the EEOC. After that, it's done. If you were discriminated against on January 1st, and then you were in the middle of trying to get your stuff together, and then it was August 1st, and you go to file, nope, too late, you're done. You cannot do anything about it. You waived that right because you waited too long. There's also things with once you go through the internal agency process, you're getting an exit letter from doing the EEO interactive process before you file the Form 5 with the EEOC, which you have to do on a very quick turnaround time. Then you have, I believe it's 15 days to initiate the charge with the EEOC. Thereafter, you have to wait with the EEOC until you get a right to sue letter, which you cannot compel within less than 6 months from the date that you file. Sometimes they adjudicate it sooner, but you cannot compel them to. Otherwise, you failed to exhaust your administrative remedies there as well. So there's a lot of legal mechanisms and stuff. But the point being is that if you're denied provisionally or initially, appeal, go through the process. If you get denied again, appeal and go to the EEOC. I'm going to be working with as many people as I can to get them the information as to how to do that. But make sure that you're cognizant and you're paying attention because you have an obligation to, you know, somewhat protect yourself.
So where we're at right now is this lawsuit that you filed is for federal employees. Does that include the military?
Yes. So though it does. And that's why, and I have two Marines in there who have been denied. And one of which is in the appeals process. The other one is about to initiate it. One of which is supposed to be in the getting promoted on December 1st. So that issue there is I'm also pushing for him to get back pay in the event that he is not giving an exemption. Promotional pay that he needs, because they're allowed if there's something pending, they can delay or toll the promotion. But if they do toll it and then they find that he was wrongfully denied, then he gets that back in turn. So that's something that's really important as well.
And then what about contractors? What about people working on government contracts? Does this extend to them as well?
So people that are in the and this is something I keep getting a lot of the time. I think the most prevalent group of the people in New York City, first off, New York City employees are subject to a very different, that's apples and oranges. Even though the effect's the same, it's not the same type of law. It's nothing that I'm dealing with. I'm not touching it. I'm not doing anything in New York yet. Perhaps I will get to it, but right now my main concern is the federal government because it's just the greatest number of people.
Yeah.
And federal contractors right now, the executive order under federal contractors, the biggest difference is that there's a very different compelling governmental interest at stake. The test for something when it goes into infringing on a fundamental right, such as religion, deals with what's called strict scrutiny, which requires it to be the least restrictive means necessary, or in other words, narrowly tailored to a compelling governmental interest. The compelling governmental interest, if you look at Section 1 of the policy under Executive Order 140-42, it specifically states that the purpose of the order is for economy and federal procurement. So it's for efficiency in the government procuring contracts. It's economic incentive. The economy part is not, it's not for, when it's saying economy, it means efficiency. It doesn't mean like strictly like straight up money, but the efficiency is in turn for, you know, liquidity and solvency and financial benefits to the government. That is very different than protecting for the health and safety. So the analysis is going to be very, very different in terms of how you can go about proving or disproving that it is not the least restrictive means necessary. And it's not your obligation under strict scrutiny. The government bears the burden to prove that it is the least restrictive means necessary and that it does, in fact, achieve a compelling governmental interest. So the compelling governmental interests of the two orders are different. And also waiting on OSHA to issue the ETS because federal contractors are private sector employees, the issue there is that what does it come down to when you're in the private sector and your employer is mandating it? It goes back to the same sort of principles that we were seeing with the mask mandates, where, you know, any private employer could mandate masks if they wanted to. It's no different than a club saying you can't wear a white t-shirt or you can't wear backwards hats or you have to wear a collared shirt here after 5 p.m. Those are all personal regulations that, oh, do they infringe on your free speech or freedom of expression? Sure they do, but they're not the government. The people need to remember that the First Amendment prohibits or protects against governmental infringement, not private sector infringement. That's why people keep talking about free speech and First Amendment rights with Facebook and social media. They're not the government. I mean, I think that there's some merit to making the argument that they are quasi an agency almost at this point, but they're not officially the government. They're a for-profit corporation when it comes down to it. And that's where the issue is that the for-profit corporation sometimes acts like the government, but it is not the government.
Well,
why your fundamental rights are not infringed.
Yeah, they have actually now focused on proving they are the government, which is happening. So, you know, once we get to that point,
Yeah, which is huge, because once they can prove that, then obviously the First Amendment rights, you know, your First Amendment freedoms will apply.
Yep.
That's really where it comes down to. But in the interim, take it like a small mom and pop shop. Let's just say that there's a restaurant, okay? They're obviously not the government. That's crazy. You know, no one's going to make that argument. But if they want you to wear a mask, they can do that. My issue is what happens when the owner of that restaurant does not want to make you wear a mask and you go there, but you have to because of the governmental order. So that's the same thing that we're seeing here, which is with the federal contractors. They're pointing uphill saying, look, I got to do it because of the government. But in reality, the federal contractors analysis is very different. So once the OSHA ETS comes out, if I can get rid of the executive order under 14043 and require that they make room and make way for religious exemptions, then I can use that to piggyback, transfer over into arguing against 14042, get that to be taken away. And then if I can nix both executive orders in that capacity, then obviously the OSHA ETS is not going to be able to be promulgated or issued without telling the private sector that they're not allowed to have orders absent religious exemption availabilities for private sector employees, because it's all downhill. So what I'm doing is I'm creating this carve out by attacking the lowest hanging fruit that applies to the greatest number of people, and then just cloning it and slamming that argument into each different case. And your honor, you already held this once. This is the same situation. Apply it here. Okay, boom. Apply it here. Boom. And you can see like the domino effect as it starts to go down. And it's called non-mutual offensive collateral estoppel is the legal doctrine that would be applied under.
So today, Mike, we're waiting until noon. It's 10:54 a.m. Eastern time right now when we're recording. I think Frank is hopping off in a second. So, Frank.
In just about a second, but I really appreciate this. I had a couple of questions about the emergency use authorization stuff, but I can talk about that with Tracy at another time, I guess.
Do you want to just ask a quick question?
Or you can ask me now. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the thing that really, this is, of course, going back to the beginning of the interview, but the thing that really confuses a lot of people is, of course, this consensus. And I think that the consensus is the biggest problem that we're facing as far as picking battles that we think we could win, using religious exemption, which is obviously a very real thing for people, their religious beliefs, their spiritual beliefs, morality, all that stuff. But really, the other thing is, outside of, I know plenty of people who are center left or far left even, who don't want this shot. They believe in bodily autonomy. They are also atheist or agnostic. They have absolutely no religious or spiritual practice or anything in their lives. And they just believe in, I don't want this for myself. Now, the reason why this is such a big problem is because there is a consensus among the medical establishment, the legislators, the judicial branch, and all that stuff to hold up pretty much bad habits, not necessarily law or not necessarily any law that would be based on any constitutional order, as the way that things are. So I think that's the scary thing about what you're up against and proving efficacy, because you can say that, hey, we have all this information here that shows that the shots are not safe. But if the establishment is saying, no, they are, then that's that's just the way it, how do you fight against something like that? That's number one. That's just the bigger question about the fight. But the other thing is people are confused just about what the whole idea about this emergency use authorization is. Pretty much the establishment says it is approved. But when we do a little bit more digging, we hear say, oh, well, it doesn't seem like it's approved. It seems like the EAU has been the EUA has been extended, that there is still the testing period is not going to be done until 2025, 2026. What is the actual, what can you tell us 100% is the status of these shots as far as the bureaucracy that is the FDA? When do they actually become approved? What are people lying about right now? That's what nobody knows, because one person says it's not. It's just been extended, the EUA. And then somebody who watches Don Lemon every night for news says, no, it has been approved. You're getting misinformation. It's very confusing. I don't know what to tell people sometimes.
Well, let me just pull up the lawsuit and I'll just read to you the very, very, very clear answer to that question, which is a product of deception, of course, but when you really break it down, it's very clear. So I say in some, like I'm quoting in a summary as to the urgency of this request, and I quote from the executive order. So it says, first, EO 14043 on its face states that, quote, the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine, also known as Comirnaty, has received approval from the Food and Drug Administration. That is the language that Biden included in the executive order. That is a lie. It is a lie. It is a lie. It is false. It is unequivocally not true. It's perhaps true that Comirnaty is what Pfizer BioNTech is known as. But when you have when you get in a car, that's a Lyft, and you call it and you're like, oh, I'm getting in an Uber. Well, yeah, you're in a Lyft and it might be known as an Uber because Uber is like the sort of name for it, or whatever brand you have. You just call it a Kleenex instead of a facial tissue, but it doesn't make it that. And so it's saying that it's known as Comirnaty. Well, it's not Comirnaty. That's the biggest difference, because then I put right under it language from the FDA's approval letter that says, quote, the FDA approved Comirnaty COVID vaccine and the FDA authorized Pfizer BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine under emergency use authorization. So it's very distinct, and I painstakingly and very descriptively and clearly articulate throughout the complaint the differences between the two vaccines, and not only just the differences, but the actual status is being recognized as distinct. Comirnaty is FDA approved. It does not exist in the United States of America. No one has ever received a dose of it in the United States of America. And Pfizer BioNTech is the vaccine under EUA that is available. Pfizer has two vaccines. The reason that people keep saying, oh, they're the same thing, is because no one will give you what's actually in the vaccine. There's the only thing that you can tell is that there's not even the same number of ingredients between the two. One has 11, one has 10. You don't know what the actual differences are. But the bottom line is that Pfizer and the FDA have both admitted publicly that there are two different vaccines, and the FDA said that they are, quote, legally distinct with certain differences. That right there is the crux of the issue. So if you go in and go to, if someone wants to even try it out, go for it. You go to get vaccinated and say, oh, do you mind if I see that vial? If you ask them if it's FDA approved, they're going to say yes. Ask them to see the vial, because the vial is going to say on it emergency use authorization. They're not going to have a vaccine that says Comirnaty. They're not going to have it. They're not going to be able to show it to you because it doesn't exist. So ask yourself if they're the same thing. If you can't see if you can't get a vial of a vaccine that doesn't say on its actual label that it's approved by the FDA, are you really going to sit there and continue arguing that it is FDA approved? Of course not. It's nonsensical. So that's the distinction there that I think people need to make. And then to answer your other question about people that just don't have religious beliefs, they don't like to do certain things. Well, you know, you could be agnostic or atheist and not want to put in your body, but I don't want to. What about if you don't want to wear a seatbelt? I just don't want to wear a seatbelt in my own car. Well, it's the law.
That's fine.
You know, that's the law. You don't get everything you want. You have to have some sort of rule and order for a civilized society. And if you don't have a legitimate reason not to do it, then you're subject to it. That's just how it breaks down.
But there is no law that says that you must inject yourself with an FDA-approved vaccine.
No, it's just bad habits. They're held up, somebody creates a precedent, and then that's just, it becomes this, it masquerades as law, it masquerades as moral, and that's the whole problem here. And I don't you know, the whole seatbelt
thing. I don't agree with that, but don't. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. Nonetheless, I mean, I completely agree in the sense that I don't think anyone should be forced to put a vaccine in their body, especially one that doesn't work. Nonetheless, but at the end of the day, that's one of the things that people have to take up with the legislature, and that's why society and culture shifts and things like that matter so much. Because if you work for an employer that, I mean, the real issue is why are there so many people that want to mandate the vaccines? Because if you work for an employer that doesn't want to mandate it, you're not going to have to do it. If the government can't force an employer to mandate it, and your employer doesn't want to mandate it, you therefore are not going to be subject to it. So it really is about information more than anything.
Yeah. So, well, Frank, thank you. Sorry to keep you over. It's 11.
Oh no, don't. Hey, listen, I'm happy. I love being in on these. I'm glad I could get that in because I was. You know, I mean, it's so many other questions came and went as well, but Sorry. They were all answered. No, they were answered, and it was good. But I'm glad I was able to put this in there because I know those very basic things really it keeps people frozen for a while. And even if you know, I guess even if you do know how to articulate this, we're up against massively brainwashed people who really don't know their ass from their elbows anyway. So it's like talking to a sponge. All right, well. I'll talk Bye, to Frank. You guys a little bit. It was great to meet you, Michael.
Nice meeting you as well. Take care.
All right, take care.
So, Mike, to close it out, because you spent an hour with us today so graciously, I guess the biggest question for you is, or the last thing to say is, it's 11:03 now. By 12 o'clock, the government has to have something in. Personally, I'm rooting for them not to submit because I think that would be far more wide-reaching for everybody if they didn't. If they don't submit what the judge is looking for today, do you think she will rule on the TRO and cause this ripple effect across the government today?
Well, so it could be actually even bigger because she indicated in her minute order that she was going to have an expedited briefing schedule. And if you have a TRO, like I said at the beginning of this, you don't need to have a briefing schedule. You don't need to have an opportunity to be heard because it's ex parte. But I filed an application for a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction. Mm-hmm. And a preliminary injunction does not have an expiration date. That goes all the way through. And it can often be converted into a permanent injunction because the facts aren't in dispute. Here, that's very unlikely to happen just because the facts are most likely going to be in dispute. But what's important and noteworthy about it is that if she's putting out an expedited briefing schedule, then that means that they're going to have a chance to, you know, have their due process rights, you know, flushed out. She very well could end up not enjoining on TRO, but waiting until Tuesday for the government to file their opposition, me to file my reply brief, and then deny their opposition, grant my motion, and issue a preliminary injunction instead of just a TRO. That would elongate this out for months until the end of the litigation. So that could be even bigger is what I'm ultimately hoping for is what's going to happen. But either way, there's no way that right now the posture that this case is sitting in, there's no way that it's just going to get shut down and thrown out like the California courts are doing or like the New York courts are doing for other workers. So, you know, at its core, it ultimately is going very well and people's jobs are. If I was a federal employee right now, even if you don't understand everything I'm saying, then the one salient point to take from this is that if you've submitted a religious exemption request, you have a great deal of breathing room to rest easy this weekend, knowing that your job isn't going to be taken away from you, you know, just because you're not vaccinated and that there's a lot of recourse in light ahead for you. So don't fear the worst. And even more importantly, do not go get vaccinated if it violates your religious beliefs or if it violates what you are medically able to do based on a physician's recommendation. So keep yourself safe. Do not let your fear drive poor health or moral decision making, and you know, it'll all work out for the best for everyone.
You're fantastic. I'm sure that I'll have you back again to talk about this in more depth because we're going to be covering it every step of the way. I have been waiting for you to have a case like this since I first met you, and I'm excited that you have one right now because you're brilliant. Where can people find you again? Give them your website one more time.
Yeah, you can find me online. My website is yoderesq.com. That's yoderesq.com, or on Instagram, Yoder_ESQ. And you're going to have to search my whole name because if you type me in even a little bit, it does not come up. So you have to type the whole thing in Yoder underscore ESQ and then hit search and maybe I'll pop up.
Maybe. I'll link it in the show notes below so people can click. Thank you so much for spending this time with us today.
Not a problem. I appreciate it.
I'm Jerry Petuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out radioinfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, radioinfluence.com.